Okay, there's a lot of stuff in these chapters, as you may have noticed. Very much of it is repetitive. So you should know the things that I mentioned specifically in class, but the book will supply practice for if you look at some of the other. I expect you to be able to do most of the mechanisms in there, but there's a lot of lore that this reacts a little better than that or so on. Obviously, we're not taking enough time for you to internalize all the lore, but the lore that I convey to you explicitly in class, you are responsible for, okay? Okay, so we're moving on to chapter 18, but first one more thing about esterification, which is subject in chapter 17. You remember the Fischer esterification, which involves substitution at carbon, starts by addition to the carbonyl, and then RO comes in and OH leaves via that tetrahedral intermediate. Now, something that I couldn't tell you about last semester when we were going through the history of how organic chemistry developed was about Victor Meyer. We mentioned him just a few lectures ago because Gomberg worked with him briefly. Do you remember what Gomberg did when he was in Victor Meyer's lab? Yeah. Right, okay. He made tetraphenyl methane, right? Which was a big challenge because it was so sterically hindered, right? And most methods wouldn't do it. Gomberg had to use a new method. But in fact, Victor Meyer is the guy who invented the concept of steric hindrance. He did it in 1894 on the basis of an experiment that we're going to talk about with esters in just a second. He said the source of this behavior is stereochemical, the space filling of the neighboring groups. Now help me put this in context. Here he is in 1894. When did arrangement of in space altogether become significant other than just there being bonds? So bonds were 1858. When did people begin to think that arrangement in space made a difference? Yeah. 87, did you say? No, you're close, but it's 1874. That was Van't Hoff's contribution, right? The explaining the isomers and configuration was 1874, right? The idea of conformation, the idea that you could have chair and boat cyclohexane, which remember didn't become commonplace until the 1950s, but it was discovered almost at exactly this time in 1890. Do you remember who had the idea of chair and boat cyclohexanes? You'll see from way back when, Victor? Much maligned, that's right, Soxie, who died before anybody accepted what he talked about, and Bayer disputed it. So conformation was Soxie in 1891. So this idea that filling space and getting in the way of things made a difference is really a different concept from any of these others, right? But developed at the same time that these early conformation ideas came, and it was controversial for 30 years the same way, or maybe even longer, the same way conformation was. But the idea, what prompted him to think about this was that Fischer esterification sometimes didn't work. If you had a carboxylic acid that had two ortho substituents adjacent to the carboxylic acid group, so like these two methyls, then if you try to go to the tetrahedral intermediate, it gets quite crowded, right? So you get strain. So that it was impossible to use Fischer esterification to make the esters or take them apart again, because you couldn't get to this tetrahedral intermediate. It was fine to have the ester. In fact, he reported in the same paper that if you made the salt of this acid by pulling the hydrogen off, then you could react that with methyl iodide, do a nucleophilic substitution out here far away from these hindering groups. Right, that was fine. You could get the ester, but you couldn't take it apart or put it together with acid catalysis by way of this tetrahedral intermediate. So the idea of that was that there was space filling that was important to groups. Okay, so it's difficult to do this substitution at carbon by the Fischer esterification method when the R is very big, right? Because you can't get to the tetrahedral intermediate, so Fischer esterification is out. But there's another approach that was invented by someone who sat in a number of your seats, who we mentioned before, Melvin Newman, when he was a undergraduate and graduate student here. And in 1941, he developed a method to esterify this, which in fact, if anything, profited from the steric hindrance. Because what he did was to dissolve this material in 100% sulfuric acid. Now, so that's going to protonate it. Where is the best place to protonate? Okay, Sharif?
An oxygen and a carbon?
Well, there are two oxygens on carbon.
On the carbonyl.
On the carbonyl, right. And so you do that, and the reason is that you can draw a resonance structure with positive charge on the carbon here, or with positive charge on the oxygen. That's great. That's the way you would start in going to the tetrahedral intermediate. But that doesn't get you to where you want to go with this kind of compound. So it just comes off again. Right? Once in a while, it'll protonate on the other oxygen. And when that happens, once in a while, it'll break that bond and water will come off. Okay? Now, when that happens, it doesn't reverse in concentrated sulfuric acid, at least not easily, because it gets protonated. So there are two protons that went on to the OH group. And of course, H3O plus won't go back on. And there's no water in concentrated sulfuric acid. Any water is present as H3O plus. So it won't go back. So you generate this acylium ion. And the thing that was trigonal has become linear. So if anything, these neighboring groups favor that rather than hindering its becoming tetrahedral. So it's a linear intermediate. Okay, so then you take this solution and pour it into an alcohol. So when you do that, the alcohol comes in, playing the role that water did in going out, and you have the carboxylic acid. So it's possible to go through a tetrahedral intermediate. It's also possible to go through a linear intermediate, although the conditions are pretty vigorous. Okay. So you don't get the tetrahedral intermediate. Oops, I see what happened. I was perplexed as I was going on. I forgot to take out one of the slides I had in here. I was working on it. So we'll step through this quickly. What I had added was that this is an acylium intermediate. Where have you seen an acylium ion before? Do you remember? That's the thing that attacks benzene in a Friedel-Crafts acylation. Okay. Mike?
When you pour it into the ROH, shouldn't the alcohol get protonated as well?
Ah, but you pour it into ROH. So the sulfuric acid solution that you're pouring in is very dilute. So you if you poured the alcohol into the concentrated acid, then it would be protonated immediately. But there's much more alcohol than there is acid, so there's plenty of alcohol to do this trick. That's one of the ideas of it. Thanks for pointing it out. Okay, now into chapter finishing up this stuff about ketenes here. Okay, so how you can get acyl derivatives from ketene? So this is ketene. Okay, suppose you have a nucleophile. Where will it attack? Anybody got an idea? Kathy, how about you? Can't hear very well. So what do we have for a low LUMO here? Well, what two things look? There are two double bonds, two pi stars, right? In fact, there are unshared pairs on the oxygen. One of them is overlaps with the carbon-carbon double bond, but you have the carbonyl, right? So you'll attack the, as you say, you attack the carbon, right? And what's good about that intermediate you generated, that anion? Can you give a name to that anion? When you formed a bond here and now have a negative charge on the oxygen. Suppose you put a proton on the charge on the oxygen, so you had OH. So you'd have nucleophile attached here, sigma bond, OH, double bond next door. What functionality? Forget the nucleophile. What would that part up above? Double bond. It's an enol. So this will be an enolate that you add. So that anion is particularly good because it'll be conjugated with the carbon-carbon bond next door. So the book shows it this way. As these two resonance structures, the nucleophile is added. Okay. And then the protonated nucleophile can protonate on the carbon. It's better to protonate on carbon and get a CO double bond than to protonate on oxygen and get a CC double bond back to an enol. Okay, so you have an acyl compound depending on what the nucleophile is. Okay, so here are some examples in the book. So you can take ketene, reacts well with T-butanol to make an ester, with this to make a thioester, and with an amine to make an amide. Okay, so it's just a handy way to make some of these acid derivatives. In fact, you could think of it as going from one acid derivative to another, because you make the ketene by forming this double bond. You remove an H and a Lewy group from here, right? So in fact, it's an elimination to form the double bond and then an addition to reform this bond. So it's a substitution by elimination and addition. Okay. Now, the Beyer-Villiger reaction is this one. You take a ketone, react it with a peroxy acid, and get an ester. So you see what it actually does is insert an oxygen between a carbonyl carbon and the neighboring group. It inserts an oxygen there to make an ester out of a ketone. Now, just last time, I think, or the time before, we saw a similar reaction to this, one that involved a peroxy acid as an oxidizing agent. Does anybody remember? Yeah, Brian? Right, the aldehyde to a carboxylic acid. Right? Remember, aldehyde could be oxidized by O2. The first product, a free radical product, was to get the peroxy acid. But the peroxy acid itself can then oxidize this. So that's exactly the same reaction as this, except the insertion of the O is into a CH bond rather than a CR bond. So the mechanism as shown here is exactly what we talked about for that. The peroxy acid adds to the carbonyl, H on the O, peroxy here, you have a good leaving group. So the thing that displaces the anion leaving group here is R with its electrons, right? So whereas this was an H minus migration, this one is an R minus migration that then is attached here. As it takes the electrons away from here, this is of course a positive charge. So we have a positive charge either on that carbon or drawn as a resonance structure with it on the oxygen. So all you have to do is lose the proton and you have the ester. Okay, so it's exactly the same reaction we talked about with the aldehyde, except it's done with a ketone. But this idea of inserting things between the carbonyl carbon and the adjacent carbon crops up in a lot of reactions at the end of this chapter. So migration from the acyl carbon. So you can have R, we just saw R minus coming down here, attacking O, and a carboxylate left, right? So that leaves, that comes in, and you get this, right? And what it looks like then is that you've inserted X between C and R. Okay? So the Beckmann rearrangement is an example. There are others here that we're not going to detail specifically, although presumably, if you saw one and saw what the product is, you could figure out what was going on, that it's one of these rearrangements. Okay, so here's a ketone, and it's reacted with hydroxylamine. Does anyone remember what kind of reaction should happen here? Kevin, you got an idea? What should be reactive about hydroxylamine? Well, what's the acid going to do first? Okay, so you protonate the carbonyl oxygen to get an addition. What adds? The nitrogen's unshared pair will add, right? So now you have a tetrahedral intermediate. Then you could lose the amine back again, go back to the starting material, but there's something else you can lose from that intermediate. You could lose water. Okay? And then you generate what? Can you remember? It's a CN double bond instead of a CO double bond. Remember what those are called? You're probably trying to remember the specific one. The generic thing is imine, like a carbonyl. But they have special names when the nitrogen is associated with different things. And this one is called an oxime. We mentioned it in passing, and that the equilibrium constant for forming such things is very good, because the unshared pairs which are repelling one another here, one of them becomes allylic in this case. Okay, there's a little bit of review. Now, this is in the presence of acid. So if it's in acid, you can protonate the oxygen there. As we'll see in the mechanism, when it's treated with H2SO4, you get an amide. So you see what's happened is that I got the arrow in the wrong place. It inserted an N between the carbon and the R here, NH. Okay, so as the previous reaction inserted O, this inserts N. Now let's see, here I showed it in the specific case. So here's a cyclohexanone, oxime, and the product is the thing that's inserted, NH, between the carbonyl and the adjacent R group. So can anybody see how this might happen in the presence of strong acid? How do you get the R attached to the nitrogen? How do you get R attached to nitrogen? Well, here's a hint, right? There was that other arrow. Okay. Here's the hint. If you take a ketone that has two different R groups on it, and make the oxime, you can have two isomers where the OH is adjacent to the methyl in this case, or opposite the methyl. Right? And when you do this Beckmann rearrangement, treating this with strong acid, you get different products. This one ends up with the propyl group attached to nitrogen. This one ends up with the methyl group attached to nitrogen. Any ideas now about how the mechanism might work? What have we just been talking about mechanisms that for things that affect what looks like an insertion? What happened in the peroxy acid, for example? There was a migration of an H minus or an R minus from the carbonyl to the next door atom that had a leaving group on it. So when we have acid, and so this showed that it inserted into the bond that was anti to the leaving group, OH. Okay? So here we make the oxime, protonate it so we have a leaving group, and now the R minus shifts as the OH2 leaves, right? Which, so now that R group that was formerly attached to what was the carbonyl carbon is now attached to the nitrogen. It moved up here, right? And we can draw two resonance structures. And water then can add to the carbonyl here, lose a proton, right? To make this thing that's like an enol, and then lose a proton here, get rid of the charge there, and you have the product with the N inserted. But all these things, so this is R minus migration in that cation, yeah.
So you can have the same thing with an H minus migration also. Aromatic stabilization from an H minus moving.
Yeah, I think you can. The question is now whether I suspect strongly that you can. It's not a reaction whose name I think of. So maybe it's something that's never profitable to do. It's one of those things that it's always easier to get there another way so people never use it. But it certainly makes sense because H minus tends to shift typically more easily than R minus does. Okay. Now here's another example where what gets inserted into the R carbonyl bond is a carbon. So notice here's the R to carbonyl bond in a carboxylic acid. And now we have a new CH2 inserted in there. Now how did it happen? It happened by making the acid into an acid chloride, so a very active acid derivative, and then treating it with CH2N2, because CH2N2 has a resonance structure CH2 minus N plus, triple bond N. Okay, so this carbon is nucleophilic, so it can do a substitution, add and chloride leaves. Right. This thing then can lose nitrogen and migrate R to get a ketene. That is, the N2 is the leaving group and the R migrates. I think I've got the mechanism. There's where the insertion goes. So here's this intermediate. Right. And now the R moves, nitrogen leaves, good leaving group, you get a ketene. And we've just been talking about a ketene can add water to generate the carboxylic acid. Oh, water goes on, proton goes on here, or on here. And when it goes on here, you've got the product. Okay, this particular rearrangement is called the Wolf rearrangement. The Arndt-Eichstätt reaction is the procedure, including the Wolf rearrangement, that allows you to do something that's very helpful synthetically. If you have a carboxylic acid, you can have a new acid with a carboxylic chain that's with an alkyl chain that's one carbon longer. Okay, there's the R migration. Okay. Now, chapter 19 is about enolates and enols. And we've talked a lot about enolates and enols, but there's a heck of a lot of lore in chapter 19. It's a long chapter, and we're just going to touch it here and there. The purpose really being so that we'll talk about the reactions that are necessary that we'll then review in seeing how a great synthetic organic chemist actually put together a big molecule. But it involved just the kinds of reactions we're going to be talking about here. And these are still very, very important reactions in organic syntheses, even though that particular one was done in the 1940s or 1950. Okay, so we've talked about alpha acidity before. So here is the acidity of some acyl compounds. So you can take off this proton, pKa 16, better than acetone. And we've talked about this this kind of thing before. We can take the proton here to make an enolate when it's an acetate, when it's an amide, and we can also do it when it's a nitrile. Let's compare the ketone, the ester, and the nitrile. Can you rationalize the differences here? Which one is the easiest one to pull a proton off among ketone, ester, and amide? Mirov? Pardon me? All right, so the ketone is 5 powers of 10 better than the ester and another power of 10 better than an amide, right? Why? Why is the amide not good at helping form the enolate, Mara? Right. Well, what's going to happen is when you pull off the proton, you're going to make an anion here, and the carbonyl is helping that by stabilizing it. The low LUMO of the carbonyl stabilizes the anion and helps out. But if the low LUMO of the carbonyl is already being used to stabilize some other electrons, then it's not going to be so good at stabilizing the electrons that are here. So here it has an unshared pair on oxygen that was mixed with the pi star. And here it's an even higher HOMO, the unshared pair on nitrogen. So this the pi star is being used here, and it's being used even more effectively here, so it's not as able to help out. But it still helps. These are much more acidic than alkane CH bonds. Okay. Now, notice incidentally that this NH2, this has pK about 18, right? So although it's much harder to pull off this proton than it is to pull off that proton, it's even easier to pull off this proton than that one. So in fact, if this were treated with base, strong base, this is the hydrogen that would go, the proton that would go, not this one. Unless there were no hydrogens on that nitrogen. If you have two alkyl groups, then of course you can't lose the proton. Right? Now, you can also have dicarbonyl compounds, and we talked about that just a few lectures ago in the context of the Mitsunobu reaction, how they got the starting material for that. Right? So here you can see if you have two esters, you have it much more acidic than the ketone was, and obviously very much more acidic than an ester was. Or you can have two nitriles. Do you remember what was used in that making that stuff for the Mitsunobu reaction? What the active methylene was that did the addition, what its neighbors were?
Oxygen and nitrogen.
Right. It was an ester on one side, and it was a nitrile on the other side. And it had a pKa about 13, I think, as I remember. Okay, so here you can have a ketone with an ester is better than two esters, as you expect, because a ketone is better than an ester, right? And here's benzene helps out a little bit in conjugation. And with two hydrogens, it actually is quite acidic, although that's not a compound that you encounter very often. Okay, so we can understand the trends in these pKa's. Okay, now we mentioned that if you had hydrogens here and treated with a base, actually you'd take one of these hydrogens, not make the carbon anion. But if you have no alpha hydrogens, then if you treat with strong base, like lithium diisopropyl amide, two isopropyl groups on the nitrogen anion, then it'll pull off this proton, right, and generate the enolate anion. Now, we've talked about making enolates before. In fact, we're just talking about pKa's that make enolates, right? And typically, we're talking about things that are equilibria, where you make a little bit of an enolate that's a reaction intermediate, and then your base makes another one and then another one. But at any given time, there wouldn't be much enolate. But that's different in this case because this base, an amide base, is very strong. It has a pKa of 36. This LDA is also hindered, right? Now, we just saw that the pKa here is about 25, right? So where will the equilibrium lie in forming the enolate in this case? Kevin, do you have an idea? So this base has a pKa of 36, a very strong base. This base is also a strong base, but its pKa is 25. Which one is going to get the proton? Yeah, the LDA is going to get the proton. And what will the equilibrium constant be, roughly? If this pKa is 36 and this pKa is 25, 10 to the 11th, right? So this is not a situation where you have just a little bit of an enolate being formed as a reaction intermediate. You treat this with LDA, you get the enolate quantitatively, right? So it's a complete formation of enolate, not just forming a little bit at equilibrium. And notice it was important that this base be a hindered base. Why did you want it to be hindered? What other alternative is there for its reacting with this molecule? Besides pulling off, you can't pull off a proton here because there are no protons. You could pull off the proton here. Any other ideas, Sagar? What do you say? Where could the high HOMO of something like an amide react other than by pulling off hydrogen off? Yeah, it could attack the carbonyl, but this is hindered enough that it doesn't do that. So as the book points out, if in some sort of question sometime you see LDA, the idea of LDA is that it's a hindered strong base, so it's going to pull off protons, not add to a carbonyl or something like that. Okay, so it's a slow attack on the carbonyl, right? So it takes the proton faster than the carbonyl. And once it's enolate, then there's no low LUMO to attack anymore. So once you form this, that's the end of the line. You're not going to it won't just be slow attack. There'll be none once you get the enolate. Okay, now you can do hydrogen deuterium exchange using either acid or base. With acid, you go by way of an enol. With base, you go by way of an enolate. So section 19.2A here, and it's quite straightforward. You can take me through it. Actually, why doesn't someone talk here instead of me? My mouth's getting dry. Okay, Aviva, will you help me? Describe what goes on as we go across here. Unshared pair on the carbonyl. Does what? It doesn't attack the... Well, in a sense, it attacks a positive charge. Tell me this. What's the low LUMO that it attacks? It's attacking D3O plus. Right, sigma star of DO. Okay, so that breaks that bond. The D's on the oxygen, as we're shown here, and water goes away. Okay? So that happened. Now, this says it could come back again. D2O could take off this D and you're just back where you started. What else can happen, Aviva? Instead of taking this D, what else can you take? Notice you could draw a resonance structure here, where you don't put a plus charge on the oxygen. Where would you put it if you draw this curved arrow? This curved arrow says we're going to take the electrons that are in this bond and show them on oxygen, right? So this is going to be a single bond. Where will the positive charge be? On the carbon. And notice that's now sort of symmetrical. It's carbon plus bond D, carbon plus bond H. Okay, so what happens instead of reversing and going back where you started? So it takes this hydrogen and makes the double bond here, so it gets an enol. Good, okay. So that saved me a little bit of talking. Now, we're talking about hydrogen deuterium exchange. That is, we want to exchange these hydrogens with deuterium. Right? We haven't done that yet. We've just put a deuterium on the oxygen. Can anybody see how we're going to affect an exchange to get back to the starting material with deuterium here instead of hydrogen? Mustafa, you got an idea? Of this? Okay. Okay. So, yeah. So, what you want to do is take this, with that being a D, or in fact, you could take this and just use a D instead of using the H. Right? But it's clearer if it was all D. And in fact, when you do one of these exchanges, you put in D2O as solvent, or a lot of D2O, so that's no problem. There's a lot more D than H. Okay, so you're going to reverse this step. D plus is going to add here. So take this a pair of electrons there, draw a curved arrow, take D, not H here, put it on there. So now we have CH2D, that's what we want to have back here. Right? And plus on the carbon. And then, I mean, it's trivial, so just say it. Reverse everything, right? So H came off, put D back on by exactly the same mechanism. Just run it backwards. It's shown here. But that's exactly what we wanted to do. And in fact, you could repeat the exchange again and again until you have all deuterium in there. If the solvent has all deuteriums and very few hydrogens, right, it's going to exchange between solvent and aldehyde, and pretty soon you'll have all D. Okay, so that's acid catalyzed exchange, and it went by way of this enol intermediate. Now, how about if you were to try the same thing with a base? Okay, so here we have hydroxide taking away the H, right, to make an enolate anion, right? And now, this equilibrium will not lie, this is the kind of thing I was talking about before. You'll have very little enolate at any given time because you've gone from it's going to be not more than 10%. Right, the equilibrium's lying in this direction, but you get this, and once you have it, then you can put back on a D instead of an H. So you've done the exchange, and that's shown in this slide. And again, you can do it repeatedly and get a fully exchange. So that this really's got to be second nature to you. To go with an acid catalysis, you go through enols; with base, you go through enolates. But in either case, you get at the alpha hydrogen. Here to do an exchange. Another thing you can do by getting at the alpha hydrogen is to racemize a chiral center here, right? So notice that this thing treated with acid starts pure S and gives racemic material, 50-50 S and R. How did that happen? Matt, you have an idea? This is done with acid catalysis.
Does it?
Where just start as if you didn't know anything. Where would you protonate this?
Like the
okay, so you're going to protonate on the carbonyl. You can draw a single bond. It's OH, single bond C plus. Now what? What's your goal got to be if you want to racemize that center? Pardon me? You got to break one. You have to break one of the bonds to that center, and then reform it on the other side. Right. So once you have that C plus there, you take plus off here. Now you have, what would you call that molecule now that's got OH on the top and now a double bond here when you lose the proton? An enol, right? So acid catalysis goes by way of an enol. How about the stereochemistry of the enol? Is it right or left-handed? No, right? It's planar. Okay, and then what do you do?
You add the hydrogen.
So put it back on, but from 50-50 from either side, so you've got receiving material. So there's there's what you just told us about. Okay, here's the enol, right? But you could put a proton back on the carbon from either side, and then lose the proton from the oxygen, which is just reversing this, right? And you've got the racemic product. Okay, now. This lost its title. I'm sorry. So this is alpha halogenation. I'll fix it up when I pass it out to you. It's alpha halogenation. It's going to come up because this wasn't supposed to be here yet. So here's acid catalyzed halogenation. So we replace an H by an X. By a halide. Okay? Somehow we got to get the H off. Anybody got an idea how to get the H off? Richard? How am I going to get with acid? How am I going to get at that an alpha H? What do you do with acid?
If you protonate the oxygen,
yeah.
Shift down.
Yeah. So we got C plus here.
Yeah. And then you shift into double bond.
So then we're going to lose the proton, make a double bond. So now we have an enol. How are we going to get a halogen on it? How do you get a... So you got a CC double bond. Any ways to get a halogen on it? Brian? Yeah, you add a halogen molecule, X2, to an alkene. It's as if X plus was going on. So X plus comes on here, which you can draw the plus here then. Now you lose the H again and you're there. You just went by way of an enol and then reacted as if it were a normal CC double bond. So here's that mechanism. Here's what Richard told us. H plus goes on, right? Then here's what Brian told us. This displaces iodide, so you have iodine attacked here. That cation that you get when these electrons go away is stabilized by the unshared pair here being... This unshared pair is stabilized by that new vacant orbital. So you have this. All you have to do is lose the proton, and you have alpha halogenation. Yeah?
Would that step with the enol and the I2 reacting happen in an acid, though? Could you still get the I- in an acid?
Well, if anything, it would help.
Yeah.
Because to the extent that I2 gets protonated, it becomes a better leaving group. Rather than I minus, you're losing HI, which would be even better. It's like protonated in alcohol. It's an even better leaving group. So it's not going to hurt it. If anything, it's going to help it. Okay. Now, you might worry that if you do this, you still have two alpha hydrogens here. So might you do it again and again and end up with three iodines there? No, the book points out. Sudarshan?
So why would the second I minus attack the positive carbon?
Oh, why don't you add two I's to here? That's what you do with a normal double bond. I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if that actually happened. But then you'd have a carbon that had on it a single bond here. Now, after you've added I to this one, single bond, but it has I and OH. Right? So losing HCl from that is really easy and reversible. Right? You lose I minus H plus to generate a carbonyl. Right? But the carbonyl is an unusually strong bond. So that the equilibrium in that lies toward the carbonyl. So you probably do add sometimes, but you don't see that product. Okay, it's like we talked about diols, gem diols, in equilibrium with carbonyl, because OH and H can be lost to generate the carbonyl double bond. This is even better with iodide rather than OH as the leaving group. So the equilibrium always lies toward the carbonyl. Good to think about though. Okay, but if you do it with base, there was the title I was going to have, alpha halogenation. Okay, but if you have base, you do a reaction called the iodoform reaction. So with base, somebody tell me, how are we going to get out the alpha hydrogen if we're using base catalysis? Abhi? Do we make an enol? Enolate with base, okay. So the base pulls off the alpha hydrogen. Right, and now that's a good nucleophile to attack I2. So we got the H off, the iodine on. But now it's different because having a positive polarity of this carbon in the CI bond actually is going to make it easier to lose another proton. Right? So whereas it was hard to do the next reaction in the case of acid catalysis, harder to protonate and make the enol, it's easier to make the enolate when you're dealing with base. So now you can do a second reaction and a third reaction. So you can replace all these hydrogens, all these protons, by iodine. Okay, just the same as you can put all deuterium in there. Right? But then, once you have that, this is a Ci3 minus is not such a very bad anion. So this is like an acid derivative. This is now a leaving group. So hydroxide, remember we're in base, can now come in, and instead of losing the water or a hydroxide, we lose this. Right? So you get a carboxylic acid and the Ci3 minus, which is an unusually good anion, but not as good as hydroxide or carboxylate. So it can take the proton here, and we now go downhill in energy to get the stable carboxylate anion and H now for the last thing to go on that carbon. And this used to be a very popular reaction that people always did in lab, because how would you know nowadays in lab, what would you try to do to find out if you had a methyl ketone? What would you look for? How would you do it? You could do IR, which would show the ketone, but it would be not completely diagnostic unless you're very good as to whether it were a methyl ketone or some other R group. How could you? What kind of spectroscopy could you use to tell it was a methyl ketone? NMR would show that singlet for the methyl group, three protons downfield because it's on the carbon, or in the C13 NMR you'd see that carbon signal shifted down because of the carbonyl next door. Right, so you'd use spectroscopy nowadays, but in the old days, you had to do chemical transformation that gave a recognizable product. And the neat thing about iodoform is that it's a solid that you can easily crystallize, and it's bright yellow. So if you had a thing that you wondered whether it was a methyl ketone, you treated it with base and iodine, and if you got this yellow precipitate coming out, then you knew you had a methyl ketone. Because had there been other things on here, other things on this carbon, other alkyl groups, you wouldn't get all three iodines on, so you wouldn't get iodoform. And I'm going to close with the alpha halogenation of carboxylic acids, which has the very euphonic name, the Hell-Volard-Zelinsky reaction. That's one you can try on your roommates too. Sometimes people call it the HVZ reaction. So it's a carboxylic acid reacted with phosphorus and bromine to give this alpha bromination, right? And here's an example. Now, they've done it under conditions that give dibromide, and it does it in pretty good yield here, an acid bromide. But in fact, it's very common to do it with just a little bit of phosphorus so that it's catalytic. The key feature in getting the alpha bromine is to get an enol form. And it turns out that acid halides enolize much more easily than carboxylic acids do. So you have to get the alkyl bromide, which you're not surprised that PBr3 will convert an alcohol into a bromine. But this then easily enolizes, and then just as the case where Brian helped us out, Br2 can add here. So you get the alpha bromo bromide. But the neat thing is, as shown on the next slide, that you can use just catalytic amount of PBr3. You don't need very much. And what you get is the acid. Because the acid bromide, of course, can react with the starting material acid, right? Which forms an anhydride. Carboxylate comes on, bromide off. So you got that, right? But now bromide can come back on and displace carboxylic acid. This is all in equilibrium here. But it can come on the original one to go back to the original alkyl bromide or acyl bromide, or it can do the other one. And now you have a bromide, which is what you needed for the starting material here to do the next bromination. So it goes round and round and round, and the ultimate product then is this one up here, which only has the alpha bromination. Okay, that's what we'll do today. Tomorrow we'll conclude as many of the things in this chapter as seem reasonable to me in the time allowed, and we'll do a little bit of preliminary stuff so that Professor Ziegler will be in position on Friday to tell you how Emil Fischer proved the configuration of glucose.